The Committee of the Whole will please come to order. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 72. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 72 from the Appropriations Committee, an act relating to pension accounts, creating the volunteer firefighter and EMT pension account, providing membership qualifications, providing for contributions to the account, providing for the transfer of members of the Volunteer Fireman's Pension Account and the Volunteer Emergency Medical Technician Account Board, providing for membership on the board, closing and repealing the Volunteer Fireman's Pension Account and the Volunteer Emergency Medical Technician Pension Account, directing insurance premiums to the account as specified, providing legislative intent, providing for the transfer of pension funds, requiring a report, and providing for an effective date. Mr. Chairman, in Committee Number 2, Appropriations, to whom have referred House Bill 72, Volunteer Firefighter and EMT Pension Account, respectfully report same back to the House with a recommendation that it do pass with amendments. Those who voted aye, Representatives Burkhart, Connolly, Greer, Harshman, and Moniz, 2 no votes, Representative Nicholas and Stubson, signed by Representative Harshman, Chairman.
Thank you. You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Chairman Harshman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, to do so with the recommendation that House Bill 72 do pass, and I further move the adoption of the Standing Committee Amendment. I would turn the explanation of the bill over to the good Representative Burkhart from Carbon County, and I think he'll want to work the Standing Committee Amendment with the bill. I think kind of go together and helps the understanding of the bill. So I turn it over to the good Representative from Carbon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In your inboxes, you have a handout with a big House Bill 72 in the upper right-hand corner. That handout has the Standing Committee Amendment marked up in the bill. So as we go through it, I'll discuss the Standing Committee Amendment as we go through the bill and then vote on the Standing Committee Amendment. And that makes it a little easier to understand. It's a large bill, and it's kind of a substantial, in parts, Standing Committee Amendment. So with that, I'll give you a minute to find that. Okay. Correct. Okay. So, like I said, it says handout illustrating Standing Committee Amendment right across the top. Should be somewhere in your inbox. Okay. Most of you have it. So, what this bill does is, this bill combines the Volunteer Firefighter Pension Plan and the Volunteer EMT Pension Plan into one plan. And this comes at the request of the Volunteer Firefighters Pension Board and the Volunteer EMT Board. And I'll give you a little bit of history. The Volunteer Fire Plan was set up in 1967 for volunteer firefighters. And I think after this recent tragedy up in the northwest part of our state, we know the value of volunteer firemen who spent days fighting a fire. And they get nothing for that. But to encourage their participation as volunteer firemen, volunteer EMTs, the state set up in 1967 a volunteer firefighters pension plan as an incentive and somewhat as a reward for their service to the state. Not long ago, several years back, is when the volunteer EMT plan was established and as a separate plan. Okay. So what happened was there was always good funding for the volunteer fire plan, and that funding comes from a tax on fire insurance premiums. There's a 1% tax on all fire insurance premiums written in the state, and a portion of that tax currently 50%, and it's kind of a complex formula, let's just say 50% of the fire insurance premium tax goes to fund the volunteer firefighters plan. At the same time, when the EMT plan was set up, they weren't given a good source of funding. They were given some upfront money, and that money will run out. Last session, there was a bill to help the volunteer EMTs to help their plan make it more actuarially sound, actually keep it from going broke in the near future. It's not broke yet, but it will be. That bill failed. So the volunteer firemen, volunteer EMTs got together, came to this body and said, would you combine the plans? Well, that sounded like an easy thing to do up front. Hey, we just combine them. Well, it became a lot harder. Actually, it became impossible, and it became easier to just write a new plan. And that's what you have in front of you. The new plan it does some really interesting things. It brings the volunteer fire plan into modern terminology, modern funding methods, modern benefits that are very comparable to all the other state plans. They had a kind of an odd plan based on years of service, but also age at which you entered the plan. An oddball, an outlier there in our retirement system. What this bill does is it creates the volunteer firefighter and EMT pension account. It's right there on page one, line one and two, and it forms a new pension plan. Okay, and I'm going to go through this section by section to explain what the sections do for you. The first one being definitions. I'm on page two, and it defines a number of things that are important to the plan, like we define all of our terms in the bills we use. If you go over to page three, line four through six is the first standing portion of the standing committee amendment. Deletes the term entry age because that no longer applies in this plan. It was a carryover from the original plan, and after the bill was drafted, we determined it no longer applied. There's no entry age requirement. Okay. That resulted in the rest of the definitions having to be renumbered. So you see there that we merely renumbered the Romanettes on through. Now on page four, again we renumbered, but Romanette 8 is an important item in there for the volunteer EMTs. Many volunteer EMTs are not true volunteers in the sense we have in the state. They volunteer for their employer. Some of our very large employers have their own emergency response people who are actually paid by the company. They don't get paid as EMTs. They get paid their normal pay, but they respond as a company EMT. This was not to cover those people. It's those people who volunteer in a public status for a fire, you know, a local town, a community, local ambulances, and give willingly and freely of their time. As someone told me, their father was gone every 4th of July as a volunteer. had to do with many of the pyrotechnics devices used, I think. So, in the middle of that paragraph, it says persons performing EMT services for an industrial ambulance service as defined under the statute or privately owned or for-profit ambulance service shall not be considered volunteer EMTs. Eliminates those people from getting a benefit. We're looking at the true volunteers who provide a service to their communities. Okay. And again, moving through there's a definition of volunteer fire department to make sure that, again, it stays volunteer. It's not a paid department. It's not a industrial fire department, as some people here are familiar with. Okay. On page five, again, due to paragraph 10, Romanette 10, defines what a volunteer firefighter is and who may and may not receive a benefit. Page 6, you have section 35.9.617. It sets up the account, establishes membership in those accounts, and it merges the two plans together. And everything is paid from the one plan to either firefighters or EMTs who work on a volunteer basis. And all administrative expenses are paid from that plan. On page 7, paragraph C, this transfers all the monies from the two separate accounts into the one new account being set up by this statute. D transfers all of the members of the two separate plans to the new plan. And it also transfers the current retirees. So we don't have outlier plans in there where Wyoming Retirement Service has to keep track of multiple plans. This actually condenses their workload tremendously. Okay. On page 8, paragraph E specifically transfers all of the volunteer firefighters into this plan. Okay. On F, it defines that the benefits under the new plan are equal to or greater than the benefits of the old plan. No one loses a benefit. If anything, under this plan, they improve their benefits. Page 9, paragraph B, controls, that puts a control on the state's liability in this plan, that the state is only liable for the funds available to the account. No other funds. So if something would happen to the plan, the state's general fund can't be, say, attached to pay for any of the plan. It's what funds are there and are contributed up to that point. Paragraph C tells what happens if the account or the plan is terminated for some reason. 35.9.619 merely covers that the plan can accept other monies. A firefighter feels very generous and leaves all of his belongings and earnings to the plan in their will. That's covered that they can take care of that and accept that. Okay. Page 10, B covers consulting actuaries who will do the calculations of the plan. Paragraph A, moving down the page on 10, indicates that the agencies, whoever the volunteers work for, forward the amounts, the payments of premiums to the plan. Page 11, top paragraph, starting in line 5, whether an entity makes a contribution for a member shall be at the discretion of the entity, meaning the cities and towns can make the firefighters or the EMTs payment for them, but doesn't have to. Some of our communities do that, some do not. Paragraph B, right below that, you can't have dual membership in this plan and another. For example, we may have highway patrolmen who volunteer as EMTs in their off hours. They can't participate in both the troopers plan and this plan. Okay. Paragraph 359621 enumerates the benefits. And again, if you look on your sheet, is another part of the Standing Committee Amendment, talks about retirement age and service requirements as specified. Talks about monthly payments being made to the plan. And those monthly payments, the premiums, It talks about the benefits that are paid, and those benefits equal $16 per year of service for the first 10 years of service, and $19 per year of service over 10 years of service, and that's on a per monthly basis. That is their benefit that they get. On page 12, line B, or paragraph B, again, part of the Standing Committee Amendment to conform all the language, and again through there. And it talks about spousal benefits in that. Paragraph C at the bottom of 12 talks about the same similar benefits to children. Page 13, again, conforming language on those. At the bottom of 13, paragraph D sets 60 years of age as with 5 years of service as the retirement age. And that also puts in a five-year vesting in the program, which they don't have now. There's no vesting for the firefighters in the current program. So this gives them the benefit of a vested amount after 5 years. Okay. On page 14, paragraph E indicates that the firefighters' contribution to the plan, their monthly premium, is $15. And that's an increase over what they were paying, and they requested that increase to help keep the fund as solvent as possible. It was $12.50, and they asked it to be raised to $12.50.
Okay. On page 13, top of the page, line 1, the sentence starting on the death or retirement of, again, this talked about entry age, and it's just that sentence that gets deleted by the standing committee amendment. Okay. Paragraph F talks about withdrawal provisions, and that if they withdraw, their account is valued at a 13% per annum interest, which is about what interest rates for these are going right now. Paragraph G talks about delinquent accounts and the fact that with a delinquent account after a period of time, it reverts back to the board so that they don't keep these hanging out there of delinquent accounts. And some of them, they hang for quite a while, and then they can't find the people. This helps the retirement system dispose of those delinquent accounts. On page 16, G covers it's conforming language, and it's there. I've added it. You can see where I've crossed out some, and it's that paragraph I've included in there to help you understand what the wording looks like. And that goes on to page 17, where the first sentence is deleted. On that paragraph, starting at the top of page 17, there's a longevity statement giving the firefighters the ability to continue to pay into the plan. Volunteer firemen, sometimes they come into a plan. They may get a little, this is not a pun, burned out. May leave the plan and want to come back in. This lets them continue that little gap in service without any loss of benefits. Paragraph K talks about military service. Paragraph M at the bottom of 17 is a death benefit. And 16 through on to page 19, on to page 20, again, are death benefits to the family. On page 20, 35.9.623 talks about the formation of the board of this new plan. Our retirement plans have boards, and this talks about how the board will be made up. And it continues on to page 21 and says that members of the current board will comprise, the current two boards will combine and comprise this board. At the bottom of 21, 35.9.624 talks about the board compensation and board duties. Going on to page 23, on 23 it discusses hearings and appeals, what happens if you don't like your payment. 35.9.626 at the bottom of page 23 talks about adjustment of benefits in case of impairment of the funds. All of a sudden we have another 2008 and the fund loses money, that it can be adjusted to account for that impairment. 35.9.627 on page 24 talks about purchase of service credit. They can purchase 5 years of service credit. And our plans have this. The big plan has that. Employees can pay the money and buy 5 years of service. Okay, on to page 25. Again, in paragraph A, there is some conforming language. And this is where it starts talking about how the plan is funded out of the fire insurance premium tax. And that being, in this new plan, we'll raise to 70% of the fire premium tax. And we'll get to the fiscal note in a minute. Okay. Paragraph I, or Romanet I and double I or Romanet 2 talks about achieving 107% funding in the plan. That funding is what the retirement system considers necessary if they ever wish to give a cost of living adjustment to meet the statutory requirements on the retirement plans. Okay. The other thing is in there too, the plan would be funded at about 100% by the year 2043, or actually in this plan it will be closer to 2025. We've deleted that language as part of the amendment. But it matches the goal of this body to have our retirement plans 100% funded by 2043, and we're way ahead of schedule on that on all the plans. Okay. And that. The other thing it does is indicates that after 107%, that the funding would drop back to 60% of the fire insurance premium tax. And that amendment that you have continues over on page 26, and it's at the top of the page, the lettering, the typing up there. It was just easier to insert it there and glue it onto the page than it was to try to get it on page 25, even though that's where the amendment goes. And this is an important part of the plan. It says, after the account achieves 107% actuarial funding, the board shall recommend funding amount of not less than 60% of the gross tax levied upon fire insurance premiums. Recommended funding under this section in an amount greater than 60%, which results in an actuarial funding level greater than 107%, requires approval of the legislature. We keep control over that funding. About halfway down the page, 912.1305 is again just clean up language on it, and talks about the small business investment credits. On page 27, middle of the page, Romanet I talks about the funding, and this is where you get into how that fire insurance premium tax is calculated. It changes to 70% of the gross premium tax levied upon fire insurance premiums being deposited in the account. And starting on line 9, for the purposes of this paragraph, the gross premium tax levied upon fire insurance premiums is equal to 30% of the gross premium tax levied upon all property casualty and multiple lines insurers. Now, what that means is that very few fire-only policies are written. They're all comprehensive lines. You've heard that term. You have comprehensive coverage on your vehicle, on your house. That's what it is, because it's hard to go and buy just fire insurance. They sell you a liability package with it. They sell you some other things. And so that's what it's really calculated on. So what they do is they take 30% of that, and based on this definition, then it's 70% of 30%. I know it's a little difficult. It takes a while to get used to talking in percentages of percentages, but that's the calculation. So you can look at it as straight 21%, I guess. That fire insurance premium tax was originally put on, it's a 1% tax that goes on all fire insurance policies. 1% of the premium is a tax. And it was originally intended to fund things like this retirement account. Currently, it's 50%, which means the other 50% merely goes to general fund. Okay. So that's the bill and the standing committee amendment. So I would, Mr. Chairman, call for a vote at this time on the standing committee amendment.
Is there any discussion on the standing committee amendment? Question has been called. On standing committee amendment number 1, all those in favor indicate by aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chairman.
Oh, my apologies,
Chairman,
Representative.
There is also a committee of the whole amendment.
Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You should have committee of the whole amendment number 1 to House Bill 72. And on page 25, line 11, it changes the word month to quarter, because that's how they're paying out the payments. So it's, again, that's a conforming language to what we're already doing. And if there's no discussion, I call for the question on the standing on the committee of the whole amendment.
Question has been called. All those in favor of committee of the whole amendment number 1 indicate by aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. We are on back to the original motion on House Bill number 72. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chairman, if I may, please.
Representative Burkhardt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Okay, if you go over to the last 2-3 pages of that packet on your desk, you'll find the fiscal note. And the fiscal note is important. You need to look at it. What this fiscal note says, and there are a lot of numbers, and there are
deductions, additions in there. What this will amount to is an additional money coming out of the fire insurance premium tax, thus at this time would be coming out of general fund of $1.1 million additional to pay these premiums for the firefighters and the EMTs. So it adds money coming out of the general fund. I do want you to be aware of that right up front. There is an increase in appropriation out of that that is going to hit the general fund. And I guess it depends on how you feel about the volunteer firemen and EMTs, whether you like that or not. Okay. The next one is a list, and it is a several column list, indicates the difference between the volunteer fire plan, the volunteer EMT plan, and the proposed combined plan in benefits. And you can see that initially there's a slight reduction in benefits, but in the long run, there's a nice increase in benefits for these people. If they have longevity in that service, they're going to get a better benefit when they retire. Also, the last page then, and I've marked the column with a star. If you look on it, it's column 9, is the actuary, the funding ratio, meaning how sound is the fund. 100% means they have enough money to pay everybody out. Actuarials like to see 80% or better. And it shows that the fund, under the scenario of bracketing that amount, the fire insurance premium tax, between 70 and 60, that works out to be 100% funded in about 2025, 2024, somewhere in there. So that's the bill. Benefits of the bill combines the assets. There is some economy of scale in that one entire retirement plan is eliminated in favor of one new one, so we combine two into one. Creates a new formula for benefits. Provides a survivor benefit that doesn't currently exist. Provides a vested of service which currently doesn't exist, and accounts for non-vested members who terminate. Provides a long-term funding source for the EMTs and includes them. So, and ensures that no one loses anything under this plan. And Mr. Chairman, with that, I'll stand for questions.
Thank you, Representative Baldwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I rise in supersize support of this bill. This is one of those bills that has to do with some of the unsung heroes in our communities and in our state. And I know nobody in this body travels much, but if they did, chances are, if anything happened much anywhere out in the highways or anywhere in this state, it would be one of these unsung heroes that comes out to help you. These are people that give of their own time, often in the middle of the night, often late in the middle of the night, all night, away from their jobs, and still return to their jobs the next day. These are people that don't get a lot. Some get a small amount, most get nothing. And this is an opportunity we have to help them out and make this something that we term as valuable for them. Even those in this body that live in areas that aren't so rural, that are fortunate enough to have paid people to do this for them, their lives are touched by some of those volunteers as well. Around some of the smaller areas, around some of the bigger counties and the bigger populated counties and cities in this state, there's many volunteer firemen and many volunteer EMTs, and they deserve our report and for that our support. And for that reason, I would rise in strong support of this bill and would encourage your support as well.
Thank you. Representative Yagi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just need some information, I think I'm getting some of these same questions around me. This is a volunteer firefighters and EMT fund, and yet we're the volunteers that don't get paid for it, as the last speaker just said. I just need to wrap my head around, if they're volunteers, help me understand the pension plan, the insurance plans, if it's all volunteer. So there must be some permanent staff that help run the EMT and help run the firefighters. And then underneath them are all our volunteer folks that we have in our communities that was just mentioned also. Could you just give us a little bit of overview of, it's a volunteer and yet it's not a volunteer. So help me understand that, if you would, please.
Representative Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple questions. When I look at the fiscal note, it's hard to understand how much exactly they get. They're being funded now through this insurance premium tax, and how much annually or biannually this increases the current finances or the expenditures. In other words, what are we losing out of from our general fund dollars if this bill passes? So if you could clarify those two things, I'd appreciate it. Then also, if it's my understanding that over the past 15 or 20 years, there have been numerous increases to the volunteer fireman account. So if you could walk through how much that's been increased over the period of the last few years and when those increases occurred, I would also like to know that. And then it's also my understanding that this talks about a match or a certain amount that certain volunteer folks pay in. It's my understanding that all of them don't pay that in, that the county or city or the fire district where they're in pay that fund in. So they actually don't pay any dollars in. But could you clarify that for me one way or the other? And after that, I might have a couple other questions. Thank you.
Representative Burkhardt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to take those last questions first that the good representative asked. How much money annually is this going to cost? I said it was an increase of $1.1 million, and that will, again, I'll tell you, hit the general fund. Currently, this plan per year would be probably somewhere between total $2.9 and $3 million for the first several years and then drop back. And that pushes that 107% funding that they need. Now, we're already paying out $3 million less, about $1.9 million is already being paid into the current plan for the volunteer firemen. So the total amount is right around $3 million, $2.9 something, and that is an addition of $1.1 that will hit the general fund. I want you to be very clear on that. Okay. The increases to the volunteer fire plan over the years, and I do have the numbers here. You have to give me a minute to find them. Okay. Since 1967, they've received five benefit adjustments or cost of living increases, one or the other, and they amount compounded to somewhere around a 200% benefit increase over the years. So if you look on that chart of the various benefit plans, and you look in the first column for the volunteer firemen, that number in there is roughly 200% of what they originally started with in 1967. Okay, and that I hope that's clear to everyone. Then the match, who pays the match, the $15 that the firefighters pay, some of them pay that themselves. Some of them, their fire service pays it for them. And that is normal. That happens in the state agencies. A lot of state agencies pay the employee's share of their retirement. Most of you don't realize that. In fact, most of them pay most of it. So I hope that answers those questions. Now, to the previous questions about who runs the volunteer plans, are they really volunteers? And these people are. If you're injured in an accident on a highway, most likely, if it's in the middle of nowhere, it's a volunteer who's going to be picking up off the highway. These people do volunteer their time and effort, and that comes out of their own bank of time that they have available to do what they like in life, and they volunteer it to their community. They respond out of the kindness of their heart. They don't usually get paid for this. They don't. There's no remuneration normally in that. They have a service that certifies volunteer firemen. They have to go to training. I don't know if any of you have ever been firemen. There's a considerable amount of training they have to attend. They also have to attend meetings at the fire department to keep their, call it, fire level certification active. And that they have to participate actively. They can't just sit around, drink beer, and talk about the house that burned down. They have to actively participate in the activities of the fire department. So the volunteer EMTs have a different way to be certified, and that is they have to keep patient contact points or go to refresher training every year. And they have to accumulate so many contact points, meaning they treat people. They're the ones that help you. That's why if you go to the hospital, a lot of times the first person that checks you in is a volunteer EMT. They're doing that to maintain their certification. And then they have a board, both of the separate plans now, pension plans now, each have a separate board, again, of volunteers. They don't get paid, who do all the paperwork, track everyone, and literally track every member on a monthly basis and send that in to the Wyoming retirement system so that they can be added into the system. And they really are volunteers. The EMTs work under the auspices usually of a doctor. They have to have a medical advisor. The fire departments, frankly, most of our towns, even if they have some paid fire people, are also staffed by volunteers. I believe the city in the center of the state has, I don't know, 36 paid firefighters and 100-plus some volunteers who don't get anything. And these people don't get paid. The reason for the plan initially was to encourage people to do this. If you notice, most of the firemen, firefighters, most of the EMTs are getting older. We all are, I guess. And it's to encourage the younger people to participate if they put a good bit of time in grade, so to speak. They get a retirement. It won't keep them healthy during retirement. It won't give them a living during retirement. It's an award from the state that says, thank you for your service, and we're willing to put some money behind that to encourage your participation. So I hope that answers the questions.
Thank you. Representative Allen?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I rise in support of this bill. In our particular county and many other rural counties that are big in this state, the response time is long, and when we had that big fire up in the northwest part of our county, if it weren't for the relief firefighters from Down County, who knows how big that fire would have gotten, because those firefighters were near exhaustion. They would work till 4 o'clock in the morning, but for little pay, and there is a lot of gray hair appreciation is the word I'm looking for. But it's not only that, but it's recruitment. We need these new firefighters, so I urge you to vote for it.
Thank you. Representative Summers?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I stand on in support of this bill. In these rural, not to repeat, but in these rural communities and rural counties, we really rely on volunteers, and it's a way to incentivize those volunteers, and I just think we should support the bill and support that volunteerism. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Speaker Pro Tem?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to share a little bit of the history behind this bill that causes me some of the concerns I have around it. And I do want to start by thanking the good representative from District 15, because he has put in tremendous amounts of hours working with the parties involved and trying to smooth out issues in order to bring the bill in front of you. And so he has done a tremendous amount of work. But the question that causes me to ask is not whether we value our volunteer firefighters and EMTs, because certainly we do. It's really, is this bill aimed at, what problem is this bill aimed at resolving, and does it resolve the problem? And I'll tell you, we started out with this bill because in 2008, we adopted an EMT pension plan, and it's funny, we adopted that when we were struggling to find financial solvency for the rest of our retirement plans. But we started a new retirement plan, and of course, these decisions on pension plans are generational. These appropriations, these commitments are going for decades into the future, and so you need to keep that in mind as you evaluate the bill. But we put significant amounts of money into the EMT pension plan to fund that plan as it was getting on its feet and you were getting folks paying into it. And sure enough, we're now to the point where we have exhausted those funds that were put into the plan. And as many of us suspected at that time, it's not a self-sustaining plan. So we have to find out some way to prop up that plan. And so that's how the discussion started. And then we had this the volunteer fire plan. And so the thought was, let's merge the two of these together. But this bill has sort of taken on a life of its own, because as we have merged those two plans together, now all of a sudden we have a bunch of volunteer firefighters saying, no, we're not going to agree to do that unless you sweeten the pie, unless you raise the raise our benefits. And so what was intended to address the issue of solvency of the EMT problem all of a sudden begins, turns into a huge benefit enhancement, and not huge, that's an overstatement, but a benefit enhancement to volunteer firefighters, and what we heard was a $1.1 million per year commitment going forward. I would submit to you that, yes, the EMT pension plan, we need to make sure it's financially solvent. We need to make sure it's there for those that have paid into it and will pay into it in the future. But is this the right solution? I would submit that it is not.
Thank you. Chairman Patton,
personal privilege, please. I get two privileges today. First off, though, is to introduce some folks from Sheridan. Bruce Hoffman. Hoffman Golden Dome in Sheridan, Nalien Healy, Katie Sherwood, who is the chairman of the board of Sheridan College, and Walt Rogge. Please give them a hand of warm welcome for their service.
Welcome to the House.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for the personal privilege, and now I wish to speak on behalf of the bill twice. This is the second opportunity I've had to be in the position of supporting this measure.
Please proceed. Representative Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to follow up on the representative from Casper, you know, sitting on the Appropriations Committee, you're always balancing dollars and balancing interests and where money goes, and it's always a balancing act. So the question to me, the first question in this is going to be $2.2 million a biennium out of our general fund dollars that's going to be gone. And if we do that, then my thought is, well, we ought to replace it with something, or somehow these funds need to be replaced with something, because you know, one of the reasons we just passed a budget amendment is because some people don't know how to control their budgets, and they spend and they spend and they spend. It's not an issue of whether or not this is a great cause. I've worked for a volunteer fire department. I was their volunteer attorney for many years doing their work, because that's a great system. That's a great program. And I want to do everything I can to promote it. And so to me, it's fiscal responsibility, number one, but also the genesis of this whole thing was to save the EMTs. And so now all of a sudden we've got a $1.1 million a year in additional benefits because it's impossible to say no. So it just makes it a very, very tough issue. And in addition to that problem, last year we had a proposed bill to fix Fireman A. And for those of you who don't know, Fireman A is another retirement fund that right now is $70 million underwater. And if we don't do something, then we're going to come up with $70 million sometime in the near future, or 10 years or 15 years. And actually, that number goes up over the years as we don't fix it. 2 years ago, it was $64 million. And so what our proposal last year, but it died over on the other floor, was to take part of this premium fund to help fund that deficit. And so by taking this next 20%, we just lost a big mechanism to fix Fireman A. And so it's kind of moving dollars around and doing the right thing and how you go about doing it and a balancing of dollars. And so, of course, it's a wonderful program. I have some very good friends of mine. But I'm just saying, is this the right time and the right place to do it, given our current budget issues and what we know are going to be our budget issues in the future? I have a separate bill, if this bill dies, that fixes just the EMTs and makes it fiscally sound, because that's the right thing to do. To me, we got to take care of our unsound problems before we add into new accounts. And so to me, it's just it's a tough issue, and it's the right thing to do, but they're both the right thing to do. So thank you.
Thank you. Chairman Harshman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to kind of gently nudge back at my colleague from the center of the state. And, you know, it's not just our small little rural towns And I think in my community, in the center state, we have the larger incorporated city that has paid firemen, but all of our smaller cities that are connected to our town, they're all volunteers. And then as I drive home each weekend, and those of you folks who go to Guernsey and you know about Glendale and the lake and all those are all covered by volunteer EMTs all summer long, all the accidents on I-25, all those folks are volunteers. So the question was brought by the good representative from the Senate of the State, what are we trying to fix with this problem? The EMT program needs fixing. But also we want to do provide an incentive, and we come to an agreement where the volunteers pay a little bit more, the local entities pay a little bit more of their share, and then the state through the fire premium tax, which has been a historic use for that tax. It's not something new that we're doing. We're just taking a little more of that premium tax. All three are coming in to provide a little bit more benefit. And if you look at the handout that's in your box from the good representative from Carbon and actually look at the benefit amounts, I mean, just take a look at the folks that are coming out in the middle of the night to, you know, pump on your chest when you have a heart attack or meet you in the middle on the interstate, and just look at the benefits. And so a person that serves 20 years under this proposed bill, their monthly benefit of retirement is going to go up $20. And again, part of this contribution is out of their own pocket over all these years. And so in our rural state, we lose our volunteers, we're not going to have any. I mean, who's going to pick that up? Who's the next EMTs in your small community that are stepping up? There's no folks in their 20s doing this. And so we've got to fix a lot of problems. One of them, the key ones, though, is this recruitment and continuing to keep these folks in the system. And then I'd just add that we have not increased volunteer fire at all for the last 8 years. And it's a very modest increase out of a fund that we've traditionally used to fund the volunteer fire. So I think of all the work we've done in the last 5 years in appropriations, and this is a joint bill, and as we all the work we've done, this one probably has the most agreement from just from groups coming together to kind of solve a couple problems. So again, I'd echo my appreciation to the representative from Buffalo, the representative from Rawlins, who have served as our liaisons on the retirement board, and all the good work that they've done to get us this point. So I'd urge your support of the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Burkhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a few quick comments. The problem, the question was asked, what problem are we trying to fix? And the volunteer EMTs were underfunded. That plan would have gone broke. It still will if we don't make a change. Combining an old antiquated style program, which the volunteer firemen had, with a very new style program, which the volunteer EMTs have, proved impossible. You just couldn't combine them. They had to write a new program. The concept being no one loses benefit, and that had to result in a gain of benefit. And if you look on that chart, if you don't stay in long enough, yeah, there actually is a reduction in your benefit. The idea is to push people to stay in that service. So, and yes, it's a benefit enhancement. We did give them some extra on a retirement. That's up to you to decide if that's needed or not, or worthwhile or not. Cuts into the fire insurance premium tax. That tax was originally put in place to fund things like this. Up until right now, currently, 50% of that's going to the general fund, and the other 50% funds the volunteer fire. We're taking extra money out of that. And again, that will come out of our general fund monies. That will hit the goldenrod that's on your desk, because we've gotten used to living on money that was originally set aside for these sorts of things for the fire service. And if there's no further discussion, I'm sorry.
Chairman Lockhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In committee, we had extensive testimony from people that are actually on the ground trying to get these jobs done. And this looks like a fix to a problem that is really important, mostly to the smaller communities where you have to depend on volunteers and the occasional compensated person to help save lives, put out fires, do all of the kinds of things that make Wyoming the place to live.
Full disclosure, I was a volunteer fireman for 5 years, and I know what it takes. You get out there and you ruin your suit and you don't get home when you're supposed to and take a chance in your life. So those are things that we're asking these people to do. I think this is a good improvement on the attractiveness of having people to continue to be volunteers, and I hope that not just volunteers, but to do a job that we need done in this state. So I urge your support of the bill.
Thank you. Is there any further discussion? Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Harshman's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, to do so with a recommendation that Bill Number 72 do pass, say aye. Opposed?
No.
The motion passes. Thank you very much. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 105. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 105 from Representative Blackburn, an act relating to the administration of government, creating a task force on next generation 9/11 emergency communication services, providing for a study on the implementation, management, operation, and development of the next generation 9/11 emergency communication services, requiring a report and providing for an effective date. Mr. Chairman, Committee Number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, to whom is referred House Bill 105, Next Generation 9/11 Task Force, respectfully reports saying back to the House with a recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Those who voted aye, Representative Blackburn, Byrd, Edwards, Gay, Jennings, Kirkbride, Lindholm, Paxton, and Danswanser, further reviewed by your Committee Number 2, Appropriations, who respectfully reports same back to the House with a recommendation that it do pass with following amendments. Those who voted aye, Representatives Burkhart, Connolly, Greer, Harshman, Moniz, Nicholas, and Stubson, signed by Representative Harshman, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Zwanitzer?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move when the Committee of the Whole rise to report to do so with a recommendation that House Bill 105 do pass. I would further move the Standing Committee Amendment at this time, and maybe I can just briefly talk about that because there are two Standing Committee Amendments. What we did as part of the larger part of this bill is it's a task force, and we changed two of the members to two members of private industry, one landline and one wireless. And in doing so, we realized there wasn't a need to have a member of Homeland Security. And then we also took out an extra member of ETS and made it so the governor's office could have either a member of his staff or the Department of ETS. And so the same number of positions, but we're taking out two of the state-level bureaucratic positions and putting two private industry positions in there, and that's the Standing Committee Amendment. And I'd be happy to answer any questions on that at this time.
Thank you. For clarification, is that both amendments?
No, Mr. Chairman, that's just Standing Committee Amendment number 1, but it has a direct relation on the appropriation Standing Committee Amendment number 2 from a good colleague behind me.
Thank you. Is there any discussion on Standing Committee Amendment number 1? Question has been called. All those in favor indicate by aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Standing Committee number 1 is passed. Chairman Harshman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move Standing Committee Amendment number 2 to House Bill 105 and ask for your favorable consideration. As a good chairman of corporations just explained, with a smaller task force, the need for less dollars, and so this is the corresponding amendment. So without any further questions, I'd call for the question.
Question has been called. All those in favor of Standing Committee Amendment number 2 indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Moving on to the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to turn floor management of House Bill 105 over to the good sponsor, my colleague from Laramie County, Representative Blackburn.
Representative Blackburn.
Mr. Speaker, members of the House, now, this is a pretty simple bill. We're just asking for $40,000 so that we can implement a task force to study the effectiveness and get everybody online with 911 across the state. We want to provide access services with all communication services. provide multimedia data capabilities no later than November 2016. The $40,000 that we're asking for would be $15,000 to the LSO for salary, excuse me, per diem. For the legislative task force members, $25,000 to the governor's office for per diem and mileage of non-legislative people. The task force will exist until December the 31st, 2016. Any monies that are not used will revert back, provided by law, on June the 30th. And I'll stand for any questions.
Is there any discussion on the bill? Question being called. Oh, beg your pardon. My apologies, Chairman. Chairman Madden.
Sorry. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted the discussion briefly to explain why this couldn't be a part of an interim regular standing committee's job. Does it rise to the level of a task force, in other words?
Thank you. Chairman Zwanitz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This was brought to us from various sheriffs and chiefs and communication centers, law enforcement communication centers throughout Wyoming. We call them PSAPs, Public Service Answering Points, and there are 42 of these. With the new technology, as technology changes, you saw this immunity bill we brought last week on text to 911. Now with cell phone technology, when you call 911, it's a very different process from a landline calling 911. And so many of these current systems you'll see are changing to what we call next-gen 911 systems. My county just went through this. The voters of my county approved a tax six-penny tax capital project outlay for this. We just saw the other large city in the state, in the middle of the state, do the same process. And so as we move forward, and eventually all 40 of these are going to be buying new next-gen 911 systems, it's imperative that we have some type of coordinating entity made up of not only legislators, but state agencies and then local fire, EMS, police, et cetera, to really make sure these systems communicate. These systems are going to be $1 to $2 million each. You know, multiply that by 40. We're looking at a very large, complex network, and we need to make sure that each one of these centers can communicate with each other center. That's really the genesis for the task force, why it has to be public members as well as legislators and state bureaucracy. It is such an immense undertaking, and I'm sure many members of this body remember the WyoLink system. That pales in comparison to what next-gen 911 might bring, and so for a mere $40,000 or $50,000 on this task force and making sure we're coordinating, it'll make sure we don't have a multi-million-dollar mistake here down the road. And that's really why we feel we need a task force.
Thank you. Is there further discussion on the bill? Representative Blackburn?
If there's no other discussion, I ask for the question.
Excuse just a moment. Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like an explanation as to how this is going to be different from WyoLink.
Representative Blackburn?
Chairman, Representative, I'm not familiar with WyoLink, so I might let somebody else answer that.
First let's get Representative Burkhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll bring up a concern I had when we heard this on re-referral and appropriations, which is we have two of the largest communities in the state have already bought next-generation 911 systems that aren't compatible with each other. No matter what we do, they're still not going to be compatible. I don't think either community is going to give theirs up willingly anyway. And this puts the state in the position of being the arbiter of who gets what system. I'm not sure the money wouldn't be better off just buying software that lets them communicate with each other. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Zwanitz.
I should have never mentioned the word WyoLink in this body. I forgot. For those of you who were around in the WyoLink wars of 2010, WyoLink is a system that lets law enforcement entities communicate with one another. So your local municipality police with your county sheriffs, with the higher patrol and allows for communication statewide among entities. So if you had a fugitive driving down the interstate or crossing the state, it allows law enforcement to communicate. What Next Generation 911 is, when a citizen calls 911 and they have to locate, geolocate, especially on a cell phone where that citizen is, it's very easy if they're in a municipality and you can triangulate with three towers that exact location should they not know where they are. It gets confusing when they're in the county, 2 to 3 miles outside of the city limits. If you can't triangulate that signal, the technology is working to get to that point, but that's really what these next-gen 911 systems are. They work with cell phones. It's just a different technological environment than many of the 911 systems we've had in place for 20 years, and certainly the largest two municipalities in the state have moved this direction. There are some concerns with rerouting of calls. Should one 911 center go down for any various number of reasons, you have to make sure another 911 center in the state can pick up those calls and route them appropriately. And so the future goal is to have this be collaborative with WildLink as well, but this is a very separate system on public safety when you call 911 from a cell phone.
Thank you for that generous explanation of WildLink. Is there any further discussion on the bill? Well, the question having been called, all those in favor of Chairman Zwanisser's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, you do so with the recommendation that House Bill number 105 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
I'll say it did pass. And division has been called. All those in favor, please stand. Thank you. The motion has passed. Thank you very much. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 44. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 44 from the Corporations Committee, an act relating to taxation, imposing a tax on prepaid wireless communications access, providing for collection and distribution of the tax, granting rulemaking authority, requiring reporting, amending reporting provisions, updating obsolete language, providing for an appropriation, and providing for an effective date. Mr. Chairman, Committee Number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, to whom is referred House Bill 44, Emergency 911 Fees-Prepaid Wireless, respectfully reports back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Those who voted aye, Representatives Byrd, Edwards, Jennings, Kirkbride, Paxton, and Dan Swanitzer. Those who voted no, Representatives Blackburn, Gay, and Lindholm. That is signed by Representative Dan Swanitzer, Chairman. Further reviewed by your Committee Number 2, Appropriations, to whom is referred House Bill 44, as they respectfully report saying back to the House with a recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Those who voted aye, Representatives Burkhart, Connolly, Greer, Harshman, Moniz, Nicholas, and Stubson, signed by Representative Harshman, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Chairman Zwanitzer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move when the Committee of the Whole rise to report and do so with the recommendation that House Bill 44 do pass. I'd further move the Standing Committee Amendment, and number one, and would turn over the Floor Management and the Standing Committee Amendment to the good legislator from House District 3, Representative Kirkbride.
Thank you. Representative Kirkbride.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On this one, I will wait until after I've presented the bill to present the Standing Committee Amendment. It's somewhat technical, and it just won't make any sense otherwise. Okay, House Bill 44, Emergency 911 Fees, Prepaid Wireless. Put away those old flip phones. There's some new winds blowing here, folks. The 911 system in Wyoming is not a centralized system. Each county and some municipalities operate their own system that is only partially paid for by a fee intended for every person who uses a phone in the state. It is not paid for by the state general fund money. The law allows counties and cities, but not both at the same time, to collect a fee of up to 75 cents per phone line. The law requires the local governments place the revenue in a separate account and spend it only on certain 911-related expenses. While revenue varies widely in each county because of the user fee model, the expense of maintaining and upgrading 911 phone systems, dispatch centers, and the like is very high. For example, in my home county, revenue from the 911 fee 2 years ago was just over $90,000, but expenses to maintain the system were over $135,000. The clear intent of the current law is to ensure that everyone who uses a phone contributes to the system. However, the law has not kept pace with emerging technologies and market trends. The market in wireless phone service is moving towards prepaid wireless service, either in cards purchased at a retailer or with any of the wireless providers that now offer prepaid services rather than contract-based services. Current law does not contain a mechanism to collect the existing fee for 911 on this new option, prepaid wireless, in the marketplace. In other words, we are relying on a diminishing source of revenue for 911 service. If we do nothing and the trend continues, 911 funding will be a crisis. House Bill 44, the bill you today fairly inequitably, fairly and equitably restores the 911 as a benefit for all the people, and all people should pay at least a tiny amount of about 75 cents a month into the system. It's important to remember that this is an existing fee. It is not a new fee or tax. That claim is backed by the National Taxpayers Group that has the No New Tax Pledge. The leader of that group has sent a letter to us here in the House explaining that this fee is not a new tax. The bill is supported by the wireless industry, the county commissioners, municipalities, and the retailers are neutral on the bill. So let's go through the bill section by section. On page 1, we establish that there will be a fee of 1.5% of the cost of prepaid wireless communications in the state. The purpose of the 1.5% fee is to make it as equitable as possible with the current 75-cent charge on postpaid phones per month. Current research indicates that an average purchase of prepaid minutes is worth about $50 per month at 1.5%, that is the 75 cents. The percentage fee also protects lower-income consumers from having to pay 75 cents on each transaction instead of just once a month, like on postpaid. On pages 2 and 3, we have the requirement that the fee must be separately stated on the receipt or invoice so the consumer knows what is being charged, and exempts from the fee de minimis purchases of 10 minutes or less, or $5 or less. On page 4, we direct retailers to collect the fee and remit it to the Department of Revenue. The bill allows retailers to retain 3% of the fee collected to cover their expenses of complying. On pages 5 and 6, there's the government, the Department of Revenue's collection and distribution of the fee back to the counties, and the DOR retains 1% of the total of their costs. The distribution formula is a fair and simple formula agreed to by the counties and municipalities that gives every county 3% of the total off the top, equaling 69%, and the rest distributed by population. Page 7 clarifies that local governments can only use this fund for 911-related expenses. On page 7 and 8, it also requires further study to ensure that the 1.5% rate over time remains equitable with the postpaid charge. On pages 9 through 12 are confirming and technical additions to the current law to mesh prepaid wireless into the 911 emergency fee statutes and to establish liability for paying the fee. Page 13 establishes a reporting requirement on local government to ensure that there is sufficient oversight by the legislature on revenues and expenses for 911. On pages 14 and following are, again, conforming and technical additions. Then I wanted to explain Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, which has about four parts, almost all of which are just little technical corrections beginning on page 2, line 22, there's an insertion relative to statute 3915.104F. The rationale there is that the citation is too broad, and adding Roman numeral 11C makes it specific to prepaid wireless. On page 5, line 3, after suppliers, we deleted may and inserted must. The rationale being all intact transactions must be documented for audit. On page 7, line 7 through 14, there's deletion of a paragraph and a relettering on line 20. And finally, on page 11, line 3, we insert the words for the purposes of section 69108 and 69109 after the word including, and retain the remainder of the sentence. The rationale being there that we didn't want to inadvertently capture the big box store that housed the independent service supplier that actually was selling the prepaid wireless equipment and cards and minutes and so forth. So it's just, again, another technical correction. So I would call for the question on House Standing Committee Amendment number 1.
Question having been called. All those in favor of Standing Committee Amendment number 1 indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion carries. On to Standing Committee Amendment 2, I presume. Chairman Harshman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd move Standing Committee Amendment number 2 to House Bill 44 and ask for the body's favorable consideration. Members, we just deleted Section 3 of the bill, which was the appropriation for $282,000, renumbered Section 4, and really it's not clear in any fiscal note or anything. It just basically says $282,000 for the purpose of preparing, administering, and enforcing the tax. And you know, really every bill comes with these kind of requests from every agency. Last night we denied one for, I think it was $1.2 million for a position and a half to administer 77 people. And so I think we just try to use our judgment on the Appropriations Committee that how big is the agency, how big of a ask is this of them that might be different from what they currently do, those kind of things. And really, this is what they do in revenue. And we felt they had the resources to go ahead and implement this and without the additional appropriation. So I'd stand for any questions and ask for your support.
Any discussion or questions on Standing Committee Amendment number 2? Question having been called. All those in favor of Standing Committee Amendment number 2, please indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Back to the bill. Representative Kirkbride.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I would simply stand for questions on the main bill.
Any questions or discussions on House Bill number 44? Question having been called. All those in favor of Chairman Zwanisser's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a recommendation that Bill number 44 do pass, indicate by saying aye. Those opposed? The motion does pass. Thank you very much. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill number 83. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill number 83 from Representative Winters, an act relating to religious freedom, creating a Religious Freedom Restoration Act, providing definitions, limiting specified governmental actions that burden religious freedom as specified, authorizing claims and defenses against governmental action that burden religious freedom as specified, providing for severability of the act, and providing for an effective date. Mr. Chairman of Committee Number 1, Judiciary, to whom is referred House Bill 83, Religious Freedom Restoration Act, respectfully reports saying back to the House with recommendation that it do pass. Those who voted aye. Representatives Halverson, Croker, Crone, Pinnell, and Winters. Those who voted no. Representatives Baker, Esquivel, Miller, and Pelkey, signed by Representative Miller, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Miller?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Bill number 83 do pass. And the Representative Winters will explain the bill.
Thank you very much, Chairman. Representative Winters.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have the privilege of presenting to you House Bill number 83 today and ask for your favorable consideration. But before I delve into the bill, I feel that I need to give a bit of a background for it because the question that this bill is addressing is, should the government be free to apply the law to your religious belief however it wants to? Until about 1960, more or less, the rule was what one might call a statute-by-statute exemption model. And religious objectors got exemptions if and only if the statutes provided for one, like, for instance, a draft law during time of war. And judges got into the act only insofar as they created common law exemptions from judge-made common law rule. And those exemptions were trumpable by statute. The clergy penitent privilege, for instance, was an exemption from the duty to testify. But then, in 1961, the Supreme Court suggested that the Free Exercise Clause sometimes constitutionally mandates exemptions. And in 1963, they expressly adopted the constitutional exemption model, which held that a sincere religious objector had a presumptive constitutional right to an exemption. And in 1972, they reaffirmed that opinion. And that period from 1963, which extended all the way to 1990, was often referred to by advocates of freedom of conscience by the joint names of those two cases. Of course, a constitutional exemption model has never been interpreted to say that all religious objectors get an immediate exemption. A wide range of generally applicable law, murder law, theft law, physical assault law, divorce law, and all of those are applicable even to a religious objector. Even in more controversial cases back in that 1960 era, such as bans on race discrimination in education or generally applicable tax law, the court found that religious objectors' claims had to yield. And so to distinguish cases where religious objectors win from those in which they lose, the court used what was called strict scrutiny. When the law imposed a, quote, substantial burden on a person's religious beliefs, such as mandating behavior that the objector saw as religiously prohibited. Under this strict scrutiny, religious objectors were to be given an exemption. And if they were denied an exemption, there was a framework that could be used. The court had to use two things, and here they are, the least restrictive means of serving a compelling governmental interest. But then in 1990, the court seemed to change course, and that's why we are here today. And a 5-4 decision, a 5-justice majority, returned to the statute-by-statute exemption model and rejected the constitutional exemption regime. That decision, by the way, was widely condemned by all sides of the political spectrum. Unfortunately, that coalition has somewhat fallen apart, but it was very strong back then. In 1993, a congressman who's now a prominent senator, who is not of my party, nor could he be accused of having much in the way of concurrent ideology with me, introduced the Religious Freedom Restoration Act in Congress. And from the beginning, it was designed to give religious objectors a statutory presumptive entitlement to exemption from some generally applicable laws, subject to the strict scrutiny that we've already described. It states today in the U.S. Code, Title 42, Chapter 21B, government may, quote, substantially burden a person's exercise of religion only if it demonstrates that application of the burden to the person is the least restrictive means, there's the first part, of furthering a compelling governmental interest. That vote, by the way, in 93 was unanimous in the lower body of the federal legislature. And in the upper body, it was 97-3. And they meant for the act to apply to all branches of government, both federal and state. But in 1997, the Supreme Court held that the act exceeded federal power. And so because of that ruling, since 1997, 19 states have enacted the state versions of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. 6 states have seen their state courts weigh in with interpretations of their state constitutions to follow that pre-1990 strict scrutiny model. Now, I love what our Constitution states, our Wyoming Constitution states regarding religious liberty. It's found in Article 1, Section 18. It says, the free exercise and enjoyment of religious profession and worship without discrimination or preference shall be forever guaranteed in this state, and no person shall be rendered incompetent to hold any office of trust or profit or serve as a witness or juror because of his opinion on any matter of religious belief whatever. But the liberty of conscience hereby secured shall not be construed as to excuse acts of licentiousness or justify practices inconsistent with the peace or safety of the state. And that, my friend, is a powerful statement. I'm glad I live in the state with that in the Constitution. But as you can see, there is very little or no methodology or framework to determine discrimination or preference built into Article 1, Section 18. Just as the federal Constitution didn't define establishment and free exercise until later legal opinion. And the evidence shows that to this day, the Wyoming jurisprudence is not present to determine that we actually follow strict scrutiny. So this legislation is designed to close this particular gap in Wyoming law and codify a legal framework that is designed to protect every Wyomingite's freedom of conscience in the future. With that, I'd like for you to look at the bill, and I know that you've most likely had the opportunity to look through it, so I don't want to just continue to read the whole bill to you, but I would like for you to look at page 2 at the definitions. First of all, you see what burden is, and this is actually important. On line 12, it says, burden means any action that directly or indirectly constrains, inhibits, curtails, or denies the exercise of religion or moral conscience by an individual contrary to that individual's exercise of religion, including but not limited to, and it goes through four different things to try to help a person understand that. Secondly, it describes the exercise of religion. Thirdly, it speaks toward government. Then it speaks toward moral conscience. And then what we do is on page number 4, and this is, I want to try to get down to the meat of the bill, starting on line 12 of page 4, it says this, except as provided in subsection B of this section, government action, including action by anyone acting outside the color of state law, shall not burden a person's right to the exercise of religion or moral conscience, even if the burden results from a rule of general applicability. But then it goes on in section B, government may substantially burden a person's exercise of religion or moral conscience only if it demonstrates that application of the burden to the person's exercise of religion or moral conscience in that particular instance is, and here's the strict scrutiny language on the top of page 5. One, essential to further a compelling governmental interest. This returns us to that jurisprudence that was found between 1963 and 1990, and then secondly, the least restrictive means of furthering that compelling governmental interest. Now, later on, and I want to get down here, it starts on the bottom of page number 5 with line 23 and on to page number 6 at the top of the page. This act shall be liberally construed in favor of broad interpretation. I would, if you feel comfortable doing so, I would circle liberally construed, broad interpretation, and I would also circle on page 4, maximum extent. The reason for that language is to try to help us to understand that we're aiming for the 8th and 10th Circuit Court definitions of this particular action, or this particular act. Now, there have been some people that have asked me, will this allow us to do kind of whatever we want in the name of religion? And that's not true. That's not what this bill does. In section B, starting on line 8 on page 6, nothing in this act shall be construed to excuse acts of licentiousness or justify practices inconsistent with the peace or safety of the state or its laws, which protect the health and safety of the public. So you can see this is the bill in a nutshell. It's actually somewhat straightforward. But as we go through it, there are definitions that tie in and help us to understand very clearly that what we're trying to do is highlight the strict scrutiny that has been long established in federal jurisprudence, and secondly, has now been carried through to 19 different states because of a particular Supreme Court ruling from 1997. With that, Mr. Chairman, I would stand for questions.
Thank you, Representative Winters. Before we move on to discussion of the bill, I believe there is a Committee of the Whole amendment. Representative Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 83.
Please.
Thank you. And my good friends of the House, I think I'm batting about 0 for 4 today, so I thought I might as well make it 0 for 5. But in good conscience, I could not but bring this amendment. Basically, what this does is it removes the attorney's provision clause, which provides that, and if it's on page 5, 135.204B, that provides that if someone brings a lawsuit, then they can collect attorney's fees and costs from the government or from the entity that somehow infringed on the liberal exercise of your religious rights. And I bring this because this provision is what I call an attorney's gold mine. And if you think about it, and if you put it into practical just experiences, just for example, if you've got some folks at the Honor Farm or at the state penitentiary, and I've been involved in some of their demands for religious practices, and they are, I'm telling you, they are incredible. Some of them involve the illegal substance that's down in Colorado. Some of them involve the hallucinogenic, kind of the from the Wiley Coyote. There's all types of different religions out there that they can demand that, by golly, under this statute, they're entitled to do it. And it's a violation of their religious rights. And if you don't do it, that means I get an attorney to sue you. And if I win, then you're going to pay my attorney's fees on it. And that's just a gold mine for attorneys that is just, it's awful. It's a big thing. And not only that, I mean, you know, I don't know if you've read and studied this a little bit. I'm an attorney. I don't really fully understand the implications of what this is because, I mean, I could, as from an attorney standpoint, says, well, I could do this, I could do this. And I'm just going, this is a gold mine for attorneys. And so I'm not opposing the bill. I'm just saying let's not add the gold mine. Thanks.
Thank you. Is there any discussion on the Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1? Representative Winters.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I dearly respect my colleague, and so I many times often hate to oppose, but I must ask you to resist this for one very clear reason. The threat of a lawsuit, because of the cost involved, can oftentimes in itself curtail a person's free exercise of faith. And that's the reason why, though, we included the words, and you can see it there on line 20, who prevails. If you're going to bring a suit, but you're going to have to bear the potential cost of that suit unless you prevail, you're going to not bring frivolous suits. And that's what we're trying to do with those two words. Make sure that a person, if they believe they have a genuine case, a real and genuine case, is not encumbered because of their lack of finances. On the other hand, if they're just bringing frivolous suit after frivolous suit, that's the reason why we wanted to put these two words, who prevails. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Is there any further discussion on the amendment? Question having been called, all those in favor of Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1, please indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed indicate by no.
No.
The ayes have it. I assumed that we would get a division. All those in favor, please stand. All those opposed, please stand. Do I get to vote then? Do I just say what my vote? With the chair voting, the motion does pass. Moving back to the bill, is there any discussion on the bill? Chairman Zwanitzer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just need some help on page 3, where we're defining the exercise of religion, and about on page or line 9, it says that substantially motivated by a sincerely held religious belief. And can we find definitions anywhere in that, or is that left totally up to the court system? Should this go back into the court system? I need just a little help how we could ever determine if anybody sincerely believes that, and then who would determine if they sincerely believe it.
Thank you. Representative Barlow.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I also need some clarification. Page 3, line 17, color of state law. My question is, what does that mean? What is a practical application of color of state law? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Pelkey.
Just a question for the sponsor. I wanted to get back to that assertion that he made regarding the application of strict scrutiny on religious freedom in Wyoming. It's been my impression that religious freedom is a fundamental right and therefore is subject to strict scrutiny. And I'm wondering what the basis is of your assertion that it's unclear.
Thank you. Representative Summers.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. You know, I was concerned about the unintended consequences of this bill, so I had a group review it and provide an opinion to me so I could further understand it. And so I'm going to read that opinion. First, there is an issue with, or portions of it. First, there is an issue with unintended consequences. This bill has the potential unintended consequences that may not be able to be avoided during the consideration by the legislature. For example, a few years ago, there was a House joint resolution to prevent the application of Sharia law in Wyoming. Sharia law is the law embodied in Muslim Quran practices. This law could not just allow the exercise of Sharia law, it could require its application in certain circumstances if the person's conscience was so compelled. There are other potential consequences that perhaps not as radical could result because of a person's sincerely held beliefs that could stifle legitimate government action, such as government action would be held to the highest standard of scrutiny. Whether a person would assert a sincerely held belief as a reason to act or to avoid acting in a manner that otherwise would be legitimate for both purposes. Further, both the freedom of religion provisions under both the Wyoming and United States constitutions and case law decided under those constitutions already require applications with a strict scrutiny standard. The provisions of this proposed legislation are somewhat vague and may at some point be determined by a court to be overbroad or vague, both of which considerations may cause the legislation to fail ultimately. The concepts the bill promotes are so broad that both parties to any litigation involving this bill may be able to use the language of the bill to defend their positions. Ultimately, the courts will be the final decision-making entity, as they already are under existing law, to weigh the merits of the case. Courts may be overburdened by both legitimate and frivolous lawsuits brought as a result of this bill. And so I guess those are some concerns that were registered to me when I asked for this opinion. And so I would just like to have you respond to some of those concerns. Thank you.
Thank you. Chairman Patton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I yield the floor to the counsel, please.
Representative Pelkey.
I'm speaking on and against this bill. We're looking at opening a Pandora's box, and I'm beginning to become convinced from media report and testimony in front of the committee that there's really a single motivation behind this bill. Much of it's unnecessary. Much of it addresses concerns that haven't been raised in Wyoming. But the one underlying concern that I sense in the, and it was brought out in testimony before committee, was a sort of discomfort by some, particularly in the public sector, that they can't accommodate the decision in Guzzo versus Mead, which was the case that was recently decided in favor of gay marriage. As noble as this effort sounds, I'm opposing it largely on the basis that this also gives free rein to discriminate by public employees for people who are simply seeking services and from the state. And again, I urge the body to vote against this measure.
Thank you. Representative Chairman Patton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I live in a community of about 18,000 people, and we have at least 40-plus churches of religion, all operating harmoniously with one another, and, well, mostly harmoniously. Religion isn't necessarily their differences. It's kind of, it strikes me with this measure, with our freedom that we have of religion, and we've got 40, and most of all of them are of the same mode. I wonder, what are we afraid of? Are we in a position where there's some kind of a threat that is present? I take some relief as long as we're reading things, believing with you that religion is a matter which lies solely between man and his God, that he owes account to no other for his faith or his worship, that the legislative powers of government reach actions only and not opinions. I contemplate with sovereign reverence the act of the whole American people, which declared that their legislature should make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, thus building a wall of separation between church and state, adhering to this expression of the supreme will of the nation in itself in behalf of the rights of conscience. I shall see with sincere satisfaction the progress of those sentiments which tend to restore to man all his natural rights, convinced he has no natural right in opposition to his social duties. Signed by a president. I see no threat. I feel no threat. I can't help but oppose the measure.
Thank you. Madam Minority Leader. Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It seems that something similar to this has come up before. I would refer you to Statute 3522408, Obligations of a Healthcare Provider. A healthcare provider may decline to comply with an individual instruction or healthcare decision for reasons of conscience. Now, I can't imagine, I wasn't here when this was enacted, but obviously there was a challenge on behalf of a conscience at one point in the healthcare industry. So I would say that House Bill 83 is merely an extension of this. Thank you. I urge your aye vote.
Thank you. Representative Steinmetz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On and in support of this bill, and I did want to address the question of Sharia law, and you're talking about things that are basically illegal. There's things about Sharia law that don't conform to the laws of our land, so obviously that would not be exempted because you have to still obey the the law. You can't murder. You can't do those things that that law would require. So I just wanted to answer your good question there, and thank you for bringing it. And I urge your support of this bill.
Thank you. Representative Clem.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I rise on and in support of this measure as well. We're living in a day of political correctness. I mean, you can't go to a grocery store and I know that there are some employees who feel that they can't say Merry Christmas, that they have to say Happy Holidays. And this is what we're talking about here. We're talking about that you have the freedom of conscience, and that the only reason that you wouldn't have the freedom of conscience is if the government found that there was something essential to the further a compelling government interest and to the least restrictive means of furthering a compelling government interest. It's that, I can't remember the exact language that the good representative was using, but this is basically what it's saying. This isn't a complicated measure. This is just simply saying that, hey, you have the right to think what you want to think, to worship who you want to worship, and the government can't get in its way unless there is a compelling interest by the government. So I do rise on and in support of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Byrd.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm quite taken back by the discussion in this room. We've just declared that a freedom of conscience could be a statutory right to discriminate against anyone you choose for any decision you choose. I don't think our founding fathers had this in mind. I don't think our Constitution embodies those ideals, and we should surely not sink to that level. On and against.
Thank you. Is there further discussion on the bill? Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, the history teacher in me, I always want to go back, because a lot of times we base our decisions on what's the hot issue of this year. But I don't think our constitutional rights are based on what's the hot issue of this year. It should be based on a broader perspective. And if we think back to the origins of the federal law, a good 30 years ago practically or so, it came about because a government agency was building a road through land that was held by a certain tribe as a sacred piece of land. And when they sued to stop the construction, the initial ruling was that, seeing as the government wasn't coercing or punishing them for their religious beliefs, the government agency could build that road right through their sacred land. And that was the start of this whole thing. And I think most of us would look at that and say, what was the government thinking? They didn't necessarily have to have the road right there. Was there really a reason that they had to take these tribal people and build a road right through their sacred site? And as a community, as a nation, we said, no, that is unjustified. So to look at a particular religious belief or religious exercise that is maybe in the news this last year and say, well, I don't like that religious belief, therefore we don't want religious freedom, I think the question is that religious belief popular? Because the point of the Constitution and of our rights is to protect religious beliefs that aren't popular, or to protect the right to speech that isn't popular. If the community only says rights are for people that agree with me, then that is no right at all.
Thank you. Madam Minority Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, we've been having a good discussion discussing about the Constitution and freedom of religion. But I want to take us back and think about our Wyoming values. And this bill, because it is quite frankly directed at a particular group of people, and we know that because of the handout that was in our box. The organization behind that handout is all about attacking a particular group of people. And I would also point out for the body that the attorney who signed it is not a Wyoming attorney. So, you know, take it for what it's worth. But getting back to the Wyoming values, you know, I think you've probably all determined that I get a little nostalgic for my ranching roots, probably because I've been away from it for, 30 years or so. But as I come up on the 20th anniversary of my cowboy rancher father passing away, I am reminded of the comment he made and about the most critical negative thing he could say about anyone was that they didn't neighbor. They didn't help with fences. They didn't help when you need them. They, you know, didn't tell you their cattle were in their pasture. And to him, neighbor was a verb, to neighbor. If strangers happened to get lost and find their way to our ranch, we didn't walk out the door with our shotgun and chase them off. We didn't walk out the door and tell them to get the heck out of there. No, we walked out the door, and if it was remotely near mealtime, we invited them to supper or dinner, or at least offered coffee if it wasn't mealtime. In Wyoming, we're all about being neighborly. And this is not a neighborly bill. This is a bill that attacks a particular group of people. And in my opinion, has got some serious constitutional problems while we're on the Constitution. Because once a right is granted by the government, equal protection kicks in for everybody. So I do not think that government officials, I think multitudes of lawsuits would abound. But getting back to my bigger theme, you know, on most Sundays, sometimes even during the session, you can find me in the church choir down the street screeching on the high notes. And this bill is more of an assault on my religious freedom and my religious conscience than anything that might be done to challenge my religious beliefs. And just so happens that on Sunday, the scripture was about Jonah and the whale. And our minister, in explaining the scripture, actually used sort of a different part of that story. And Jonah didn't want to go to Nineveh because he didn't like the people in Nineveh. And basically, God told Jonah, well, the people in Nineveh are my people too. And in Wyoming, we're neighborly. We have to uphold our Wyoming values. This will send an awful, awful message around the country about our state, an ugly message that is contrary to everything I have learned in my entire life here and to what I learned from my cowboy rancher father who taught me the true code of the West on and against this bill.
Thank you. Is there any further discussion? Representative Winters?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There were a number of issues that were brought, and I look forward to addressing them. Hopefully, I got them all in turn. First of all, someone asked about the color of law, which, let me just start off by saying I am no lawyer, but the color of law, according to a legal dictionary, is the appearance of an act being performed based upon legal right or enforcement of statute, when in reality, no such right exists. And so you can see it's a person who is saying that I am here in my official capacity to enforce something when they actually don't have that enforcement. So for that particular question. Secondly, burden. Burden is something that is actually carefully laid out in the bill, and it was laid out in such a way that you can read it for yourself. Burden is any action that directly or indirectly constrains, inhibits, curtails, or denies the exercise of religion or moral conscience by an individual contrary to that individual's exercise of religion, including but not limited to the withholding of benefits, assessing criminal, civil, or administrative penalties, exclusion from governmental programs, and denial of access to governmental facilities. So those are just a couple things I wanted to clean up as well. This bill. Also, there was a particular letter that was read, and I know of that letter and the origin of it. And the question was brought up, will this allow for Sharia law? Will it contradict another statute that was passed on this floor a few years ago? And the question I have is, what aspect of Sharia law are we concerned about? Is it somehow the beating of one's wife, or the state has a compelling interest, according to this bill, to stop battery, so RFRA couldn't be used as a defense against beating one's wife? Is it divorce proceedings? The state has a compelling interest in requiring its citizens to all be treated fairly as adjudicated by the courts, equally under the law. So this act could not be used as an objection for someone who wants to divorce his wife according to Sharia law. If the state has a compelling interest, and we need to remember this, and uses the least restrictive means, the state wins. The bill simply will not allow the objectionable parts of any sort of law, no matter its religious background. It will not allow 15th century south of the border human sacrifice. It will not allow for the sacrificing of baby kitties and puppies. These objections are not correct objections according to this bill. It doesn't work this way. If the government has a compelling interest in its law, and the only way to accomplish the interest is by having the law, such as bans on human sacrifice and animal cruelty, the law always wins. It's only when government does not have a compelling interest, or when there are other ways of accomplishing that interest, that the person challenging the law actually wins. Now, secondly, the question was, state courts, you know, we already have something in the Constitution, and so we're all set. But let me just tell you, this act is still needed. Even if state law already were to require strict scrutiny, which it doesn't, and even if it's true that the courts had already ruled on it, let me just say that we need to build into statute what is already in the courts. And so we need to codify the requirements. This is simply a framework for the decision for a judge to follow. Now, I also heard that this is overbroad and vague. May I just say that this is modeled after a federal Religious Freedom Restoration Act. And also, it's in 26 other states. And they have never been challenged on the fact, let alone struck, on the vagueness or overbroad grounds. A couple people have made the statement that courts will be overwhelmed with cases based on this act. This act has existed for roughly 20 years, and it's not only in the federal government, but in many other states. And in those 20 years, in those 20-plus states, plus the federal government, there have only been about 250 cases total invoking this act. It's not often used. But when it's needed to defend religious freedom against government overreach, it should be available. And so I think that as we're looking at all of this, let me also address another thing, too. This bill does address a group of people. It addresses a group of people who desire the freedom of conscience. It is not a discriminatory bill. It will not allow a person who walks into a restaurant or any one of those places to have service denied them because someone doesn't like the way they're dressed or the way they look or anything like that. This is designed to help situations like the one to a state, a couple states south of us, where a situation arose where a lady was asked to photograph a wedding. Now, this lady said, I'm more than willing to photograph anything. It was a long-established business. And when she was asked to photograph this wedding, she knew that, as with any wedding, she would become an active participant in it. And that's what made it so different for her. You see, when she made the statement, I was more than willing to photograph a birthday party. I'm more than willing to photograph anything that involved just another individual, and there was no one that I wouldn't photograph in those circumstances. But when I was asked to photograph a wedding in this particular case, I knew it meant that I'm going to have to be there and tell them, now I want you to hold like this, now I want you to kiss, now I want you to do all of these things that violate my freedom of conscience. Well, ultimately, she turned that opportunity down, but actually found someone else to do the wedding for the couple. Well, she was sued according to that state's Human Rights Commission. As a result of that, she lost the case, had to pay the plaintiff's attorney fees, had to pay a fine, eventually lost her business. Something like that should never happen. We do have the free exercise of religion, and it's long established in this country. But what's happened is we've come to the situation today where, because of a series of court decisions, starting in 1990 with a specific court decision, in 93 we had to address that with a law, with a statute. In the subsequent years, in 1997, it was deemed that that statute, that law, did not apply to the states. So states have to set their own statutes, and over half of them have. We have a gap in Wyoming law. This is not a discriminatory bill. This is a bill that actually is fairly widespread, but it's a bill that allows us to have a framework if a situation arises where we can assist all people with the protection of their freedom of conscience. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Barlow.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the example, but I fail to see where the example exhibits a government action. So I need that clarification, because this is regarding government action. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Byrd.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In 1955, certain states in the southern part of this country hid behind that same argument as a part of their consciousness that it was their right to refuse certain services and other things that the Constitution will now guarantee everyone. I think we should use that as an example and stay above that. Again, this is Wyoming. We have a set of values here that I think are much higher than the rest of the country and the world. Taking this on would lower those standards, lower our views, the view of us in the, not only the eyes of the rest of the country, but the world, because it would codify and make it statutorily possible to pick out groups that you did not agree with for any particular purpose, because that term, consciousness, is fairly vaguely defined and fairly broad. So we would be codifying discrimination. It is beneath the body on and against the bill.
Thank you. Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I stand in favor of this bill that we're debating right now. Our founding fathers came over from the east of us, and they landed on these shores because of religious freedoms. Here of late, our judges have been taking away our rights, with the right of us to be able to worship our God however we see fit. They're also taking away our First Amendment right that we would be able to speak as we see fit. That is not to trample on other people's rights, but it is to give us a right of our own moral and just society that we have established in this country. I hope that you will vote for this bill and help us to retain our religious freedom that our founding fathers have brought to this country. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Edmonds.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I like this bill, and I'm standing in favor of the bill. I think the pendulum has swung. The ugliness and the viciousness and the anger that we have heard in some of the previous testimony shows that people that still think they're victims are now the aggressors. Bottom rails on top. And now they want to eradicate certain conservative cultures and religions. And they see this bill as a threat because it's a self-defense bill. I would urge you to support it because it really doesn't do anything. It affirms the rights of conscience and freedom of association that the radical left has no right whatsoever to impinge upon. Yet they're determined to do so. We need to start pushing back, and the pendulum will then settle in the middle. But right now it's gone too far the other way, and we need to reach an accord and an accommodation that we really need to leave each other alone. We can't all live under the same exact set of values. We're a very diverse nation and state, and we continue to grow more diverse. So we do have to live largely independently, and we can't have a one-size-fits-all. And these thought control bills that come from both sides are just unworkable. We need to back off, and this bill is good because it reaffirms values that we should all share in common. So I urge you to support this bill.
Thank you. Is there any further discussion on the bill? Question having been called, all those in favor of Chairman Miller's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that House Bill number 83 do pass. All those in favor indicate by aye.
Aye.
All those opposed?
No.
The motion did pass. Division has been called. All those in favor, please stand. Motion does pass. Thank you. Representative Blake.
Wow, we all need to get up and stretch our legs, I think. Privilege of the floor, Mr. Chairman.
You have privilege of the floor.
In the South Gallery are two county commissioners from Sweetwater County. We have John Kolb and newly elected Randy Doc Wendling. Please welcome them to the House.
Welcome to the House. Chairman Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Privilege of the floor.
Privilege of the floor.
You know, it's not often we get travelers all the way from Fremont County down here to Cheyenne, but today I have several of them. Please welcome our CWC trustees, Heather Christensen and Mickey Douglas, and they're up there with our new president, Chris Valdez. So everyone wave to him up there. Please stand.
Welcome to the House. Representative Yagi.
Mickey, you are standing, right?
Yeah. Privilege of the floor.
Privilege of the floor.
Thank you. It's my privilege, again, to be able to, Representative Pieperino and I, welcome our county commissioners here from southwest Wyoming. We have Craig Welling, we have Eric South. Anybody else? Well, we welcome them. We needed a break, as Stan said.
Welcome to the House. Mr. Speaker Pro Tem.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. While we're at it, I'd like to welcome one of our trustees from Casper College, Kathy Dolan, who's up in the gallery. Thank you.
Welcome to the House. Representative Allen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Privilege of the floor. I'd like to welcome our Fremont County Sheriff, Skip Horniker, in the North Gallery.
Welcome to the House. Representative Northrup.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Privilege of the floor.
You bet.
Thank you. Traveling all the way from the northwest corner of the state, we have some trustees from Northwest College. Carolyn Danko and Jim Vogt, would you please stand? John was also here. Judge John Wurzel, Haldel, thank you. Is he still here? Thank you, guys.
I appear to have overlooked the speaker. Mr. Speaker.
Mr. Chairman, privilege of the floor.
Privilege of the floor.
Please help me welcome two of our county commissioners. Over in this corner is
Tim Sullivan, one of our county commissioners. That name might have a familiar ring to you. And over here in this balcony, Heber Richardson, our newest elected county commissioner from Albany County.
Welcome to the House. Representative Burkhardt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm jumping with joy because somebody from Carbon County finally came over. So if you would help me welcome County Commissioner John Johnson. And I can't see from this angle if any of the other county commissioners are up there. And Sue Jones. And Lindy Glode. Yeah.
Welcome to the House. Chairman Harshman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Privilege of the floor.
Privilege of the floor is granted.
Thank you. We have a newly elected county commissioner from Natrona County, and you know that county, number one on our license plates and number one in your heart. I'd like to introduce you to newly elected County Commissioner Steve Schlager.
Welcome to the House. Representative Esquivel.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, privilege.
Privilege.
I want to introduce one of our newly elected county commissioners here in Laramie County, Ron Cayley. And
welcome to the House.
Also, a trustee at the Laramie County Community College and former mayor of Cheyenne, Don Erickson.
Madam Minority Leader.
Privilege of the floor. Cool. Go ahead.
I hate this mic. Privilege of the floor, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
I'm actually going to steal a privilege from my Teton County friends to introduce a newly elected Teton County Commissioner, Mark Newcomb, who also is on the board of the Jackson Hole Center for Global Affairs and took Representative Stubbs and Representative Freeman and I on a trip to China. So he's also fluent in Chinese. Welcome, Mark Newcomb.
Welcome to the House. Now, Chairman Patton.
Privilege of the floor.
Privilege of the floor.
The county commissioners from Sheridan County, we have five. Steve Meyer, Tom Ringley, Terry Krem, that's the game warden extraordinaire that changed, Terry Krem, Mike Nichol, and Bob Rawson.
All right, welcome to the House.
Yeah.
Representative Pelkey.
And then if I may.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Then if I may, a very special lady, a dear friend to my family as well as the community that has been such a supporter of the Community College and the Community College Commission for years, Charlene Bodine.
Representative Pelkey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, they say we do the people's work here, and I just wanted to extend a big 63rd welcome to those people that we have not yet mentioned. So,
is there anybody else? Representative Lindholm? I don't know. Go ahead.
Privilege of the floor, Mr. Chairman.
Granted.
I got to call him out. Weston County, brand new commissioner, Tony Barton. Also the grandson of former Senator Barton, right up there in your gallery.
Welcome to the House. Madam Chairwoman Petroff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to introduce our newly elected County Commissioner, Smokey Ray, and also School Board Member Janine Teske, who has been on numerous state education committees as well. I'm sure a friend to this body. Please welcome them.
Mr. Majority Whip.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. While we're introducing new commissioners, we have new commissioner from Niobrara County, Mr. Pat Wade, and of course there's only three people on that commission, so a full one-third turnover with Mr. Wade, so welcome.
Welcome to the House. I, I think we've come to the end of that segment of today's entertainment. Madam Majority Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman Schwartz. Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to hear another bill, House Bill 114, and that will be our last bill for today. And I would like to see if we could close up the House by 4:30. Thank you.
Well, I believe we have our marching orders. The next bill, if we are ready, or do I need to give you gentlemen a moment? The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 114. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 114 from Representative J.A.G.G.I.
That's it.
An act relating to concealed weapons, creating a Wyoming Repeal Gun-Free Zones Act, creating exceptions for the carrying of concealed weapons by permit holders as specified, and providing for an effective date. Mr. Chairman, your Committee No. 1, Judiciary, to whom is referred House Bill 114, Wyoming Repeal Gun-Free Zones Act, respectfully reports saying back to the House for the recommendation that it do pass. Those who voted aye, Representative Baker, Escobel, Halverson, Croker, Crone, Miller, Pinnell, and Winters, one no vote, Representative Pelkey, signed by Representative Miller, Chairman.
Thank you. You have heard the reading of the bill. Chairman Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Bill Number 114 do pass. And Representative Yagi will explain the bill.
Thank you. Representative Yagi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and glad to have everybody here to witness the good discussion of the House, the People's House, and this place we get the work done. I bring to you today House Bill 144, and I ask, why should Wyoming pass this gun, or excuse me, 114? Oh,
thank you.
He didn't say my name right, but now he's giving me glasses. House Bill 114. One of the reasons I bring this is to uphold the Wyoming Constitution, the most impelling reason why we have House Bill 114. Now, I can use this as a prop because I handed this out to everybody earlier in the session. And this is the United States Constitution. I hope you have this. I hope you read it. And I'll quote the Wyoming Constitution, but if you need any more of these, I ordered a bunch of them, so if any friends would like them, please come get them. But the Wyoming Constitution guarantees the right of self-defense, and it's found in Article 1, Section 24. And it says, the right of the citizens to bear arms in defense of themselves and of the state shall not be denied. So the Wyoming Constitution is very clear on this individual right for the people to bear arms. And the right is further defined by the various case law that has been brought and used for this bill. Now, if you'll remember in 2011, we passed a bill. It was called Concealed Carry Without a Permit. And when we were passing that bill, a lot of members in this body, and maybe some of the members up in the balcony there, said, wow, we just can't be doing this. It'll lead to all kinds of problems. There was an onslaught of amendments as we brought this bill on the floor, and the House, you guys, withstood those amendments and passed it out overwhelmingly without them. And what happened because we passed concealed carry without a permit? Was there all the bad things happened, the shootings? Can I tell you what really happened? The crime rate has gone down in the state of Wyoming. So now we come with House Bill 114, and I think it is applicable because we're talking now about the folks that you said really need to be the most trusted, and that's the concealed carry folks. Now, I want to remind you as we go through here, I've had a lot of emails, as you've had a lot of emails, we've had a lot of people, lobbyists, and You have to be 21 before you can ever get a gun or get a concealed carry permit. So for some of the concerned teachers that are, in the lower grades said, well, we just can't have kids bringing, it can't happen anyway. But as we do this, as we go through here, just a little reminder, in the major newspaper in the center of the state, by the way, you have two handouts. And as I taught school, I wanted to give kids what I wanted them to know, and so I just made my talking points and the bill with the changes in it. So if you'll take a minute and get these, you can kind of follow through where I'm talking. The first one I'm talking off, why should Wyoming pass House Bill 114 and repeal the gun-free zones? And then the other one is the bill with some red marks on it that show you where I'm inserting things. So I'm on page 2, and it starts off with 64% of the our college staff members support guns on campus. So the headline in the papers said the Wyoming the faculty of that school. I've got it all written in the wrong words, so I got to interpret as I go. Showed that 64% approved of carry, so only in a high percentage of return ballots, only 36% said no, we're not for this. Now I know a lot of you, and I have heard that there's going to be all kinds of problems with this bill. We shouldn't pass it. There's groups out there calling you out. And every one of us want studies. We have interim studies. We have committees. We have select committees. We have consultants that go out and get information for us. We want the best information we can have to make an informed decision. Well, folks, I'd like to tell you there's a 15-year real live study been going on, and it's the state of our Southwest where the Salt Lake is. They have had this same bill that we're talking about for 15 years. And what's really happened with all of these so-called problems that they will have, remind you, they have 10 major universities, not one, big ones, 25,000, big, big schools. They have community colleges. They have numerous high schools, middle schools, intermediate schools, elementary schools. And how many problems have come since they've had this bill? So they're way bigger, and if I can get all these, that state has honored the people's right for self-defense and guaranteed by their constitution like ours does. On the right to bear arms, they have a very similar statement as Wyoming. They have allowed concealed carry permits to carry concealed in the state capitol. They also allow open carry in their state capitol. They allowed concealed carry permits in K-12 and their public college campuses. And they don't require the permit carrier to report to anybody. You have this cherished permit, you can carry without telling anybody. Now, we go through the same thing that they do. We have to have a background check. We have to have the Department of Justice background check. We have to be checked out. We have to go through a class. And their class is no magic class. It's similar to ours. They are a little easier to get a concealed carry. We have $79. Theirs is $41. They only take about 11 days to get, once you apply for the permit, it's there. And the renewal is a lot easier also. Other states that have this carry is the Potato State, the Lobo State. If you have a permit, you can carry in their capital. And if we go to the state to our south, the Supreme Court even had a ruling from them. They banned guns on their campus, and the Supreme Court said, you cannot do that. And so on that campus now, you can carry if you have a permit. Just skipping over in the interest of time, since Representative Blake's timing me, what's happened in that state to our south since they had the real bad shooting? Well, there have been more shootings, and they're on your paper. And the state to our southwest took a different approach to it. So for 15 years, if you have a concealed carry permit, they've been allowing. How much problems they have, I've told you, there is none. So all the things that you've been hearing, this can't happen in Wyoming because this will happen and this will happen. Well, they have big schools, small schools, they have every condition that we have, but 3 million people where we don't, 280,000. And so I'm wondering the sincerity of all these folks, and I guess they wonder about my sincerity. I just really have a passion for this, that I think this is the safe thing to do. One of the things that I just skipped over there, in one of their papers, they say experts speculate on why Utah has zero related shootings. Could it be the very bill we're talking about? I'd like to take you to the bill now, if you get your bill out. What I've done is just showed you where I insert things in it, the name of the bill. Wyoming repeal of gun-free zones. We're creating a new statute on line 10 that goes after the 68104 to be 68105 that creates a statute for those people that are our most trusted that have the permit holders. On the top of page 2, we have a prohibition lifting those that hold a permit so you can carry in line 5 any government entity and any meeting of the legislator or committee thereof. I have a couple good friends, a senator and a representative from that state, and they say they just feel very comfortable carrying into the state capitol, and I don't feel quite like that. If you'll go to line 8 and 9 and 10, we're repealing 68104-4 that allows us to carry in a public school, college, professional, athletic event. And I want to stress, if it's a private place, this bill does not affect that. I really respect private property. And if somebody in their home, their business, does not want, that is their right, and I will respect that. I go into a restaurant, no guns allowed, I'm totally okay with that. Probably won't eat there, but I just respect that right. I don't want anybody to think I'm trying to take their rights away. And then if we go down to 13, any public elementary, secondary school, we go to 16, any public college, university facility, and the way it is now, I just took these right out of our statutes. So I'm just saying they were there, now we can carry in these places without written consent of the security service. And we had some good testimony on that in the committee yesterday. Now, this bill does not. These places that are mentioned here are the ones that are mentioned in our statutes. The other ones that are mentioned, such as courtrooms, and there are some other places, haven't messed with those at all. So the only thing we're changing are those that are listed right here on that page. And the one that I really wanted to have in the bill is on the top of page 3, line 2. The prohibiting of private owner from restricting firearms on his property. So again, this bill reiterates your right to do whatever you'd like in your business or on your property. And so what we're doing is just creating the new statute that does just what we said on this page, and hopefully this will become law. Now, again, you've been lobbied a lot saying all these things are going to happen. Well, I'd like to remind you, 15 years of this happening, the same thing I'm asking you folks to consider and vote for, has been going on, and there have been no problems. So I'm really wondering, of all the things that people say, similar to what they said with concealed carry without a permit. So I thank you. Representative Blake isn't there to tell me how much time I took, but I'll stand for questions.
Is there discussion on the bill? Wow. Hearing none. All those in favor of Representative Miller's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Bill number 114 do pass, indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
The motion passes. Madam, I believe we're ready to move on. Madam Majority Leader.
Mr. Chairman Schwartz, I move that the Committee of the Whole rise and report. We're moving on.
All those in favor indicate by
aye.
Opposed? Committee of the Whole is in recess.
Reading clerk will read the Committee of the Whole report.
Mr. Speaker, a Committee of the Whole, having had under consideration bills on general file, begged to leave report as follows. House Bill 90, amended, recommended do pass. House Bill 166, amended, adopted and further amended, recommended do pass. Representative Berger moved the House rise and support. House Bill 72, amended. And further amended, recommended do pass. House Bill 105, amended. And further amended, recommended do pass. House Bill 44, amended. And further amended, recommended do pass. House Bill 83, amended, recommended do pass. House Bill 114, recommended do pass. Signed by Representative Schwartz, Chairman.
Representative Schwartz.
Mr. Speaker.
Oh, hold on. I believe I have my cheat sheet still.
I move the adoption of the Committee of the Whole report.
You've heard the motion. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Congratulations, Representative Schwartz.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Messages from the Senate.
Message number 157. Mr. Speaker, the bill listed below passed the Senate on third reading by the vote indicated. Senate File 45, Digital Information Privacy Task Force, Reappropriation, Ayes 29, 1 excused, Ellen Thompson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 158. Mr. Speaker, the bill listed below passed the Senate on third reading by the vote indicated. Senate File 47, City Engineers-Duty to Estimate Project Cost, Ayes 29, 1 excused, Ellen Thompson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message 159. Mr. Speaker, the bill listed below passed the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 57, School Facilities Appropriation, Ice 26, Notice 3, one excused, Ellen Thompson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message 160, Mr. Speaker, the bill listed below passed the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 90, Medicaid Chiropractor Services, Dash 2, Ayes 27, Noes 2, one excused, Ellen Thompson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message 161, Mr. Speaker, the bill listed below passed the Senate on third reading by the vote indicated. Senate File 92, Workers' Compensation, County Elected Officials, Ayes 28, one no, one excused, Ellen Thompson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 162, Mr. Speaker, the bill listed below passed the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 97, Department of Transportation Communications Facilities, Ayes 29, excused 1, Ellen Thompson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 163, Mr. Speaker, the bill listed below passed the Senate on third reading in amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 103, Bicycle Pathway and Highway Separation, Ayes 23, Noes 6, one excused, Ellen Thompson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message 164, Mr. Speaker, the bill listed below passed the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 81, Lifesaver Program, Dash 2, Ayes 21, Noes 8, excused 1, Ellen Thompson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 165, Mr. Speaker, the bill listed below failed to pass the Senate on third reading by the vote indicated. Senate File 78, Education-Dual Language Immersion Programs, Ayes 15, Noes 14, excused 1, signed Ellen Thompson, Senate Chief Clerk.
Reports from standing committees.
Mr. Speaker, Committee Number 1, Judiciary, to whom is referred House Bill 137, Child Custody, respectfully reports saying back to the House with a recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Those who voted aye, Representatives Baker, Esquivel, Halverson, Croker, Crone, Miller, Pinnell, and Winters, one no vote, Representative Pelkey, signed Representative Miller, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your Committee Number 1, Judiciary, to whom is referred House Bill 142, Child Abuse Penalty, respectfully reports saying back to the House with a recommendation that it do pass. Those who voted aye, Representatives Baker, Esquivel, Halverson, Croker, Crone, Miller, Pelkey, Pinnell, and Winters, signed by Representative Miller, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, Committee Number 1, Judiciary, to whom is referred House Bill 145, Principal and Income Act amendments, respectfully report saying back to the House with a recommendation that it do pass. Those who voted aye, Representatives Baker, Esquivel, Halverson, Croker, Crone, Miller, Pelkey, Pinnell, and Winters, signed by Representative Croker, Vice Chairman. Mr. Speaker, Committee Number 1, Judiciary, to whom is referred House Bill 146, Uniform Trust Code, respectfully report saying back to the House with a recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Those who voted aye, Representatives Baker, Esquivel, Halverson, Croker, Crone, Miller, Pelkey, Pinnell, and Winters, signed by Representative Croker, Vice Chairman. Mr. Speaker, Committee Number 1, Judiciary, to whom referred House Bill 160, Special Warranty Deeds, respectfully report saying back to the House with a recommendation that it do pass. Those who voted aye, Representatives Baker, Esquivel, Halverson, Croker, Crone, Miller, Pelkey, Pinnell, and Winters, signed by Representative Croker, Vice Chairman. Mr. Speaker, Committee Number 1, Judiciary, to whom is referred House Bill 161, Retirement Account Exemption from Execution, respectfully report saying back to the House with a recommendation that it do pass. Those who voted aye, Representatives Baker, Esquivel, Halverson, Croker, Crone, Miller, Pelkey, Pinnell, and Winters, signed by Representative Croker, Vice Chair. Mr. Speaker, Committee Number 2, Appropriations, to whom is referred House Bill 32, Hemp Extract Regulation, respectfully report saying back to the House with a recommendation that it do pass. Those who voted aye, Representative Connolly, Greer, Harshman, Moniz, Nicholas and Stubson. One no vote, Representative Burkhart. Signed, Representative Harshman, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, Committee Number 2, Appropriations, to whom is referred House Bill 60, Trust Company Amendments, respectfully reports saying back to the House with a recommendation that it do pass. Those who voted aye, Representatives Burkhart, Connolly, Greer, Harshman, Moniz, Nicholas, and Stubson, signed by Representative Harshman, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, Committee Number 2, Appropriations, to whom is referred House Bill 70, the Omnibus Water Bill Construction, respectfully reports saying back to the House with a recommendation that it do pass. Those who voted aye, Representatives Burkhart, Connolly, Greer, Harshman, Moniz, Nicholas, and Stubson, signed by Representative Harshman, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, Committee Number 2, Appropriations, to whom is referred House Bill 71, Nursing Education Programs, respectfully reports saying back to the House with a recommendation that it do pass. Those who voted aye, Representatives Burkhart, Conley, Greer, Harshman, Moniz, Nicholas, and Stubson, signed by Representative Harshman, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, Committee Number 2, Appropriations, to whom is referred House Bill 88, Health Provider Recruiting Programs, respectfully reports saying back to the House with a recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Those who voted aye, Representatives Burkhart, Conley, Greer, Harshman, Moniz, Nicholas, and Stubson, signed by Representative Harshman, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, Committee Number 2, Appropriations, to whom is referred House Bill 103, Merit Career Technical Scholarships, respectfully reports saying back to the House with a recommendation that it do pass with following amendments. Those who voted aye, Representatives Burkhart, Conley, Greer, Harshman, Moniz, and Stubson. One no vote, Representative Nicholas, signed by Representative Harshman, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, Committee Number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, to whom is referred House Bill 126, Candidate Filing Requirements, respectfully reports saying back to the House with a recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Those who voted aye, Representatives Blackburn, Byrd, Edwards, Gay, Jennings, Kirkbride, Lindholm, and Paxton. One excused, Dan Zwanitzer, signed by Representative Kirkbride, Vice Chairman. Mr. Speaker, Committee Number 2, Appropriations, to whom is referred House Bill 130, Fireman's Pension Account Benefit Adjustment, respectfully reports saying back to the House with a recommendation that it do pass. Those who voted aye, Representatives Burkhart, Greer, Harshman, Moniz, Stubson. Two no votes, Representatives Conley and Nicholas, signed by Representative Harshman, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, Committee Number 4, Education, to whom is referred House Bill 147, Wyoming Council for Education, respectfully reports saying back to the House with a recommendation that it do pass with amendments. Those who voted aye, Representatives Freeman, Hunt, Northrop, Paxton, Summers, and Throne. Three no votes, Representative Yeagy, Patton, and Piperinen, signed by Representative Patton, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, Committee Number 5, Agriculture, State, Public Lands, and Water Resources, to whom is referred House Bill 108, Trespass Landowner Liability, respectfully reports saying back to the House with a recommendation that it do pass with following amendments. Those who voted aye, Representatives Allen, Blake, Campbell, Eklund, Hunt, Yeagy, Larson, Lindholm, and McKinn, and signed by Representative Eklund, Vice Chairman.
Re-referrals.
Chairman Zwanitzer, Dan.
Hey, Mr. Speaker. Thank you. I need to re-refer House Bill 126 to your Committee Number 2 Appropriations.
Without objection, House Bill 126 is re-referred to Committee Number 2 Appropriations. Chairman Patton.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I move House Bill 147 be re-referred to Committee Number 2 Appropriations and House Bill Number 159 re-referred to Appropriations Number 2.
Without objection, House Bill 147-159 are...
Sorry, Mr. Speaker.
Madam Minority Floor Leader.
If a bill reduces an appropriation, does it still have to be referred to appropriations if no money is appropriated?
It does, okay. Madam Minority Floor Leader, and the reason is it impacts the budget and impacts the management of the budget that the Joint Appropriations Committee is trying to do. Without objection, House Bills 147 and 159 are re-referred to Committee Number 2 Appropriations. Committee reports. I'm sorry, committee announcements. Chairman Harvey.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your Committee Number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, will meet tomorrow, 10 minutes after noon recess, in room H17, where we will hear House Bill 107, Interstate Medical Licensure Compact, and have an educational discussion from the Insurance Commissioner.
Chairman Patton.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your Committee on Education, number 4, on Friday, 15 minutes after the noon recess, will consider House Bill 198, 118, and 101.
Chairman Zwanzer, Dave.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your Committee Number 8, Transportation, Highway, and Military Affairs, will meet in about 10 minutes in H-17 to hear four bills, House Bill 181, 170, 172, and 178.
Chairman Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your Committee Number 1, Judiciary, will meet Friday, January 30th at 8 a.m. in room H-8 to consider the following bills, House Bill 180, House Bill 184, House Bill 209. We'll further meet upon the noon recess in room H-8 to consider House Bills 167 and the House Joint Resolution Number 9.
Chairman Horstman.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your Committee Number 2, Appropriations, will meet upon adjournment in room 204 to consider re-referred bills, House Bill 77, State Employees Veteran Service Credit, House Bill 143, Motor Vehicle Registration Fees, and your committee will meet upon noon recess tomorrow, Friday, January 30th, to consider re-referred bills, House Bill 122, Workers' Compensation, Permanent Disability, and House Bill 177, Collection Costs for Debts Owed to the State. Thank you.
Vice Chairman Kasperi.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your Committee Number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, will meet Friday, January 30th at 8 a.m. to hear the following bills. House Joint 7, Bear Lodge Project, House Bill 194, Geothermal Resources Study, and House Bill 152, Industrial Siting Impact Payments.
Chairman Petroff.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. May I please have privilege of the floor before
Yes, please proceed.
Thank you. So, everyone, the Women's Caucus invites you tonight to Leap Into Leadership Dinner at Little America. Cocktail hour starts at 6, and the dinner starts at 7. You're welcome to bring a guest. We'd love to see you there tonight. Committee announcement, your Committee Number 6, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources, will be meeting tomorrow, Friday, January 30th, at 7:30 a.m. in room H-10 to hear House Bill 136, Interstate Game Tag Exemption Meat Processors, House Bill 157, Pioneer Hunting and Fishing License, House Bill 135, Lifetime Archery Licenses, House Bill 154, Complementary Hunting Licenses, Persons with Disabilities, and House Bill 155, Wheelchair-Bound Hunters, Donated Licenses.
Mr. Majority Whip.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Privilege.
Please, proceed.
Would those of you, please, on the Ag Committee, just hang around for like 2 minutes after we adjourn? I've got this little poster here, which is goes along with the governor's signing of the recognition of Ag Week this week. So if the Ag Committee could hang around, we could get a picture of us holding this up. That would be great. Thank you.
Madam Majority Floor Leader, that clears the deck.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Fellow members, the list for general file tomorrow, January 30th, House Bill 87. You all do, by the way, interruption here, have a list on your desk. But continuing with House Bill 113, 153, House Joint Resolution 8, House Bill 70, House Joint Resolution 6, House Bill 145, 32, 71, 160, 88, 60, 86, 161, 138, 139, 103, House Joint Resolution 3, House Bill 108, 130, 142, 146, 128, and I'll challenge you to be done by 3 p.m. on Friday. And with that, Mr. Speaker, I move that the House adjourn until 10 a.m. tomorrow, January 30th, 2015.
You've heard the motion. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. We're adjourned until tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock a.m.